Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Right now, I would like to welcome Margaret Brown. She's director of the film The Order of Myths, which opens this Friday, December 12th, at the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe. Welcome to KSFR.
Thanks.
So this is a documentary that you made about the annual carnival celebration in Mobile, Alabama. It was shot, I guess, last year. And it's
yes.
a story to which you have family ties.
Right.
Did you grow up going to these carnival celebrations that you document?
Actually, I mostly just went to parades. I didn't really go to the balls. I wasn't old enough to go. But, it's something you do kind of when you're more of an adult. And I moved away when I was 18.
So what made you decide to do this documentary? How did you get interested in the whole politics and culture of these whole Mardi Gras balls and parades and everything that goes on around them?
Well, it was very much in my family. My mother was the white Mardi Gras queen in 1966, and my grandfather, part of the Mardi Gras celebration in Mobile is being a debutante, and my grandfather really wanted me to be a debutante, and I did not want to be a debutante, and I guess I sort of made the film instead, in a way. But yeah, it was just always in my family, and it was just such a an important thing in Mobile. And I didn't really know what was going to happen the year we were going to film. I just knew after making my first film, which was about Townsend's aunt who died before I started the film, I really wanted to film something that had a very solid beginning, middle, and end, like, carnival season.
Let's go back historically. This is the oldest carnival in the United States, dating back from 1703. That's amazing.
Yes.
What do we know about carnival in 1703 and on into the 18th century?
Well, I'm not so much of a historian. It is actually was celebrated as far as I know. Differently at that was sort of more like a big party, but there wasn't, people dressing up as kings and queens, and there weren't like, floats that were parading through town. So it was different, but, it did start in Mobile, but way before New Orleans. No one really knows that.
And yeah, no, it's amazing. And has there always been a black component to it? I mean, what you show, and we'll get into that in a moment, is the real segregation between the black and the white carnival. Did the black carnival develop after the end of slavery?
Yes, it was definitely before the end of slavery, and I mean after slavery ended. But the MAMGA, the organization that's in the film, started in the 30s, there was another society called the Order of the Doves that's not been as well documented that was before that. But, the celebrate, it's pretty recent compared to when the white celebration started. And I believe it sort of began because, they weren't allowed to be in the white celebration.
So let's talk about these two, the black and the white Mardi Gras in Mobile, Alabama. You show their preparations, including incredible costumes that a lot of time and money and effort and just aesthetic acumen is spent on, on both sides. How are these two Mardi Gras, the black and the white expressions, how are they different and how are they similar?
Well, they're similar in that they're both sort of based on a European tradition of royalty. And, I think there's a lot of curiosity in both communities sort of about, like, what the other community is doing. When I started the film, my uncle was just, and this was really amazing to me, he was like, God, I'm glad you're making, a movie about, that's partly about the Black Mardi Gras, because I just have no idea, what they do. I mean, there was a huge amount of curiosity, because it was so separate that there was just like absolute, he was just really curious about what I would find.
So what did you find? I mean, first of all, you had family ties to the white side. How did you get your way into being able to really film and get close to the black side?
Well, actually, in a weird way, the white side was harder because it's segregated, and no one really wants to say that out loud, or they claim that it isn't, people were nervous about, or certain people, certainly not everybody, but certain people were very nervous about me filming. So, you know, and I don't think the black side felt like so much they had so much to hide. So it was easier in a certain way. But really, it was, as I think it always is when you're making a film, it's about hanging out and getting people's trust and, you know, having them realize you're a person and not just a camera. So, and we filmed for 370 hours. So we were around all the time.
Yeah.
And so after a while, people just sort of got used to it. And that's sort of what made them comfortable, I think.
Yeah. There's an amazing event that took place after the slave trade was outlawed. And that was, there was a man in Mobile, Alabama, who made a bet that he could bring in a ship full of slaves. Tell us that story.
Well, the way it relates to the film is that there was a man, Timothy Mayer, who was part of a bet. He was bet that he could bring a ship of slaves to Alabama after slavery was outlawed. This is in 1859. And he won the bet. He brought the slaves to Alabama. And the ship was called the Clotilda. And the queen, the white queen of Mardi Gras last year when I filmed, was Helen Mayer, who was descended from Timothy Mayer. She was, I believe, his great-great-granddaughter. And the thing that we found out as we were filming, actually after Mardi Gras, when we were doing some interviews sort of after Mardi Gras, Stephanie Lucas, who's the black queen, her grandfather, when we were interviewing her grandfather and grandmother and Stephanie, he said in the interview that he was descended from this ship. And my idea for the film kind of going in was that it was sort of about how history was alive in the present. And to me, this connection between the two queens, I mean, there was sort of not a stronger way that you could hope for that would illustrate that.
It is quite amazing because this man, Timothy Mayer, said, if I don't come back in an hour, burn the ship to destroy the evidence. And of course, the ship was burned and everybody jumped off. And here are these people who you are filming, who were their descendants. It's extraordinary.
It is. It was. And the other thing that's extraordinary about it to me is even in Mobile, people don't really know this history of this ship. It's kind of been erased. It's an invisible history. And so I'm hoping that now it won't be quite so invisible.
So here you have a Mardi Gras where the white queen is descended from this historical character, slave owner and clearly proponent of slavery, and then the black kings and queens are descended from the people on the ship.
Well, the black queen, not the king.
Right,
the
okay,
queen.
Right. And there was, as recently as 1981, a lynching in Mobile, which you talk about in the film. What do the attitudes between these two groups look like now? I mean, it's after slavery, after Jim Crow, but, you know, just at the beginning of the Obama era, what does it feel like in Mobile between these groups?
I mean, like I said before, I think there's curiosity, there's fear of the unknown, I think. I mean, one thing I'm hoping will happen with the film is that, people just start talking about, because I think it's very hard, and not just in Mobile, but just in this country, for people to talk about race. I mean, I've shown the film now all over the country. I've traveled with it a lot. And, I don't think this is isolated, certainly not in Mobile. I mean, I'm from there, so I was able to make this film. And I felt like Mardi Gras would be a very interesting way to sort of explore kind of what's going on in our country with race right now. But I certainly don't think it's limited to, a group of Southerners. People have been able to relate to this wherever we go. But I do think, at least in Mobile, I can't speak for the whole South, but these things are kind of, it's sort of more taken for granted that things are separate. I think that people just sort of accept it in Mobile that things are like this, and they don't really question it. And hopefully, when people look at the film, they'll start to maybe question it some.
Well, it's a wonderful film for, I think, fostering discussions. I watched it with a friend yesterday, and we had a long discussion afterwards about some of the themes brought up in the film. And one of the questions that the film really brings up is, should these two different Mardi Gras be integrated or not? And I have a friend who is from Selma, Alabama, and she's in her 60s right now, so she lived through the whole Martin Luther King period and everything, and she was telling me once, she said to me, Mary Charlotte, I am not in favor of segregation, but segregation worked for me. I was a star in my high school, I was the homecoming queen, I was in the top of my class, and in an integrated school, I wouldn't have been anybody. And I was thinking about that that conversation when I was watching this film, because both of these Mardi Gras celebrations are really different in their cultural expressions, that one wonders what either of them would become if you tried consciously to mix them.
Well, I just think it's interesting that she thinks she wouldn't have been anything if she had been integrated. I mean, sort of what does that say about her attitude?
I think it was a realistic attitude. I mean, I think that in her element, and it was, you know, when I was watching your film, there was this moment where the black king and queen are welcomed by the white king and queen in a moment of wonderful pageantry, and they kind of looked a little bit nervous and out of their element.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think that these things are very uncomfortable, you know, always, because it's been separate for so long. But one thing I've noticed as the people who are in the film, Stephanie, the black queen, and Joseph, the black king, and Helen Mayer, the white queen, and Britton, who is one of the members of the court, Dora Finley, who is an activist in the black community and a historian who speaks in the film, we've all traveled together throughout the United States and also to Europe representing the film. And one thing I've seen is that, you know, as these people become friends, things that I thought before, you know, might not change seem possible. I think, I just feel like, you know, maybe these two groups won't merge, but who's to say that, like, other groups that start up might have a different tradition, you know? I mean, I think a lot of this is about power and keeping power in the hands of a few families or, you know, in certain parts. It's not just about race, it's also about class. And I think if you kind of look at it that way, you know, I don't know. I think it's a very complicated question, but I don't know if I agree with your friend saying she wouldn't have been a star. I mean, you know, it would have been harder because it would have been an era when things were just beginning or hadn't been desegregated. But, I mean, I think things have to start somewhere.
We're talking to Margaret Brown, director of the film The Order of Myths, which opens this Friday, December 12th at the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe. So tell us about the title of the film, The Order of Myths.
Well, The Order of Myths is an organization. It's the oldest parading organization in the country, and it's an image. The image of the Order of Myths is folly chasing death around the broken column of the South, and it's an image that I bet every kid in Mobile kind of grows up. It's the last sort of, the Order of Myths is the last parade of Mardi Gras because they're the oldest organization. And I always knew that that image was going to be like a fundamental image in the film because there's something primal about it. It's something that's like sort of, I mean, it's above like all, it's really about life and death. It's about sort of, you know, partying or enjoying life basically until you die, that dance. And I thought that image was something I wanted to sort of definitely be prominent in the film. But also in Mobile, this image is kind of racially loaded as well because the guys that there's a traditional way that it's always been where they ask young black men to carry these torches that now they don't use anymore because they're, you know, from, you know, they're not electric. They're they're like braziers to sort of, to go with this float through the streets of Mobile. So, again, it's like sort of this image that's sort of racially complicated.
There's this sense, I mean, they call these different groups, these different societies, mystic societies, and there's this sort of sense of mysticism that I didn't really know how to interpret, didn't know how to understand. How do you see it?
Do you mean the secret, like, how do I see what, the secret groups?
What does it mean to be a mystic society?
A mystic society means that there's groups of men or women who, like, when they're in the group, they can't reveal their identity, which is why in the film a lot of the people who are talking are wearing masks and they're talking because you're not, and people take it pretty seriously in Mobile. The older people take it a lot more seriously. It's kind of not as serious in, like, you know, people my age, but for the most part. But, you're not supposed to reveal what organization you're in. So there are these masks that throughout the film a lot of people are wearing.
So have you shown this film in Mobile?
Yeah, we showed the film in July in the biggest theater in Mobile, to like 2,000 people, sold out house. And I was, you know, pretty apprehensive about the screening, but it went really well. We got a standing ovation, and, you know, there were a few people that walked out, and there was lots of, it was sort of one of those, you know, screenings where people are talking to the movie the whole time. It was great.
So what kind of feedback did you get from people afterwards?
Well, we had a Q&A with the people who were in the film afterward on stage, and that was pretty tame. But then the next day, there's this, you know, in the paper, there's this thing called Sound Off, where you can call in anonymously and say whatever you want. And there were some pretty interesting comments in Sound Off for the next few weeks about the film and how it was stirring up trouble and how I was stirring up trouble. But no one said that at the screening. They were afraid to say it to, you know, our faces.
Was it white people saying that you were stirring up trouble, or black, or
both? I think so, yeah, but it's hard to know because it's just people can call in anonymously.
And so have you taken it to other southern cities? I mean, it seems that the film really, the strength of it is, I mean, besides it's a nice, it's a wonderful film to watch, but is the conversation afterwards.
Yes. Right, I agree. Yeah, I mean, you know, I didn't know starting the film what it was, the connection between the two queens. So I kind of didn't know what it was really going to end up being about. But I am really happy that now, knowing what it is, that it is something that starts conversations. And, I've seen it do that. Helen Mayer, the white queen, like, showed the film in New Orleans, I think a few weeks ago. And, you know, I've been to it with the film in Nashville. It showed in Memphis. It showed in Birmingham. So, yeah, I mean, it's definitely getting around to some of the southern cities, Tuscaloosa, Alabama. I can't really remember all of them.
Margaret Brown is the director of the film The Order of Myths. It opens this Friday, December 12th at the Center for Contemporary Arts in Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
We're going to take a break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR.
KSFR programming is underwritten in part by Upaya Zen Center. From Wednesday, January 7th to Sunday, February 1st, Upaya hosts their winter practice period on science and selflessness with notable teachers from the neuroscience, mind, and life communities. Also, Sensei Kazuaki Tanahashi returns with Zen painting and calligraphy, and each Wednesday evening, a thoughtful and reflective Dharma talk. More info at 986-8518 or upaya.org. That's upaya.org.
I'd like to welcome Suzanne Chambers from Open Hands and artist Bill Jackson. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi.
So we haven't had Open Hands on the air for a while. Open Hands is kind of an institution in Santa Fe. What's it all about?
Oh, absolutely, Mary Charlotte. Open Hands has been in Santa Fe for over 30 years, and we serve about 10,000 New Mexicans every year. We primarily work with the elderly and disabled, and we provide programs that help them live with dignity and independence. We have a medical equipment loan bank, our adult day service, and we also have our home safety program, as well as our thrift store, which is right over at 851 San Mateo.
So the thrift store serves to fund the other things?
Absolutely. We also have one other service, too, that some people in the community don't know about. We have a job shop, which is a handyman service, and that provides handyman services to anybody in the community for a small fee, and the proceeds also help fund our other programs.
That's a lot of things. Let's talk about them a little bit one by one. Medical equipment loan bank, is that what you said?
That's correct. The way that works is that anybody in the community can borrow assistive equipment such as wheelchairs, crutches. There's absolutely no fee for this service. And they can just go to our offices at 2976 Rodeo Park Drive East and borrow it for a two-month period.
These are people who are presumably not covered by insurance that would otherwise give them those things that they need.
Absolutely. You know, for some people that don't fall under that criteria, or maybe they just need it for a short amount of time so they can come on over and they are just welcome to borrow it. And again, it's no charge.
Now, the handyman service, that's also something that's extremely important for people who are either disabled or elderly or just not very handy, who've got problems.
Like me. No, absolutely. And that's another thing. It's available to anybody in the community. The proceeds help fund our other programs. And it's a great resource for people of any age. We can help them in terms of some weatherization. Again, there is a fee, but that service is available too.
And there was another program that you also mentioned.
Oh, sure. We do a lot of things, Mary Charlotte. We have...
Where are my notes?
We have our adult day service, is where caregivers can bring in their loved ones to be watched during the day. Those, it's for primarily people suffering from dementia or Alzheimer's. And we also have our home safety program.
So it's daycare basically for adults who really would be a danger to themselves if you left them home alone?
Very much so. And it's a great help for caregivers to really give them a break during the day.
So you don't do any of those things yourself. You are more the communications person. But that's challenging work.
Very much so. And we have just a tremendous caring staff in our adult day service program, and they provide wonderful activities. They have art therapy. They have pet therapy. So it's not like you're just, you know, they're having to be by themselves and be isolated. This is very much a service for both the loved one and for the caregiver.
Pet therapy meaning people get to hold little dogs and cats and things like that?
Yes. And we do that just a couple times a month, and they love it. So it's just a great resource.
How do you reach out to people to let them know about the services that Open Hands provides?
Well, we do it through a number of different ways. Certainly, we have a limited marketing budget, and things like this are wonderful. But another thing that we do often is that we have a lot of community outreach and other fundraising events, and which is one reason, too, why we have Bill here. This upcoming weekend, we're having something very spectacular happen. We've had 144 Santa Fe artists donate their works for a special fundraiser to help fund our programs. And that's going to be Friday, December 12th, from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Nussbaumer Fine Art Gallery, which is 314 South Guadalupe. The first night is a reception. People can come in, meet these wonderful artists that have helped us so much. The next evening, on the 13th, from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Nussbaumer Gallery, they can come and actually bid on the works, and there's going to be hors d'oeuvres and entertainment, and it's just going to be a lovely time. And I kind of like Bill to let you know how he got involved with this.
Please do. Bill Jackson.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. About 3 years ago, an artist friend of mine, Bonnie Teitelbaum, had a really unique event happen in her life. Her 87-year-old mother-in-law came to visit her to spend the winter, spend 6 months with her. Her mother-in-law's name was Hannah, and Hannah was an Alzheimer's patient. And Bonnie was really, really having a hard time, wondering how she could handle Hannah's illness. And she discovered Open Hands. She realized that Hannah needed constant attention. And she discovered Open Hands, and the Open Hands van would arrive at 10 o'clock in the morning and pick up Hannah and involve her in the adult daycare program that Suzanne was just telling you about, and then bring her back a little after 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And Bonnie was so relieved and impressed and overwhelmed by this, how well this program worked, that she wanted give something back. And she's a member of an artist group called The Artist's Voice, which was started about 5 years ago and now comprises 120 local artists who mentor each other and work together to help each other along the pathway towards becoming an artist and developing their careers. And Bonnie brought it up to the group, let's do an auction. Let's create an auction, a silent auction. Let's create art for this auction. So a year ago, we did that. And I think there were 103 artists last year, and we raised $25,000 for Open Hands. And Suzanne was telling you about this year's auction. Each artist has created a 12-inch by 12-inch original panel painting. There are some sculptures. When you have 144 artists, you have such diversity you can't imagine.
Well, I love those exhibitions, and one has them in Santa Fe from time to time, where everybody gets the same size starting point to work with, and then the diversity that comes out of it is unbelievable.
The other thing that's really unique about this event is it's a collaboration between galleries and artists, and in a sense, I think it There's an authenticity about it. The galleries provide, through their sponsorship, the money that pays for the panels. So every artist is working on exactly the same piece of panel or canvas. We have emerging artists, we have professional artists that are gallery associated, we have artists with very advanced careers, so we have all ranges of artistic endeavor.
And so the preview is Friday night from 5 to 7 at the Nussbaumer Gallery at 314 South Guadalupe Street, and then the silent auction is the next night from 6 to 9 in the evening.
That's correct. And if anybody would like some more information, they're welcome to call our offices at 505-428-2320, or they can also go on our website, which is www.openhands.org.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for being here, Suzanne Chambers, who is with Open Hands, and Bill Jackson, who's an artist. And it is quite a fine thrift store you've got there as well.
Absolutely.
And if people want to donate to it?
They can stop by. The hours are 10 to 5, Tuesday through Saturday, and they're welcome just to go ahead. It always helps to call first if they can. Let us know before they donate, but we really appreciate that.
Well, we want to thank you both so much for being with us. I'd like now to welcome Rod Harrison and Clark LeCompte. Clark is the producer and Rod is the performer in an upcoming performance called Dig, An Evening with Lord Buckley. Is that correct?
Yes.
Now, Lord Buckley, who I didn't even know about, is an amazing character. Who was he?
He was a jazz comedian. It's sort of hard to define what he did. Even at in his time, it was difficult. He was essentially a comedian, a spoken word artist. But he had no punchlines. There weren't jokes, per se. He came up in vaudeville, you know, in the 30s and 40s doing walk-a-thons, dance-a-thons, and things like that. So he was an MC, an entertainer, a musician. Midway through his career, you know, he was doing all these things with jazz musicians, working in strip clubs as an MC and things like that. And so he started picking up the jazz speak of that time, and also the hipster habits of that time. He was a real viper. He liked to smoke the grass a lot.
Now, he was born just after the turn of the century. I mean, what
Correct.
Era are we talking about?
Yeah, we're talking, well, he started recording his hip material in the early 50s. So 52, 53, he was recording these, he was putting out albums of these monologues where he was speaking in this jazz speak that most people know him for. But, you know, yeah, he was in entertainment in the 20s, the 30s, 40s. He died in 1960 at 64.
So this is somebody who was not royalty. He was not a real lord or anything like that.
No, he was not a real lord. However, you know, in the jazz sort of lineage of royalty, we have, you know, Count Basie, Duke Ellington, Nat King Cole, Lord Buckley. The jazz royalty is where that comes from. Also, he projected the manner of sort of an English lord. You know, he had a waxed mustache and often performed in a tuxedo and tailcoat and spoke in a sort of affected, enunciated voice that people thought he was English. But then he would go into these routines and just as many people thought he was black because he was doing these black voices that he had picked up. He had an Amos and Andy routine in the 30s and 40s that he was doing. And, you know, many people had Amos and Andy bits that they were doing. And so he picked up this lingo and this way of speaking, and through the Lord persona kind of elevated everything and found a way to mix low and highbrow at the exact same time, the lowbrow voice with highbrow texts. He would often perform stories from the Bible or from literature, from Shakespeare. So he took the Lord thing as far as he could. He spent his life as a lord, and everyone around him was my lords and ladies. Everyone had a royal title, and just anyone that was hip to what he was doing became an instant member of Lord Buckley's royal court.
He could sing just like Louis Armstrong.
Yeah, did an amazing Louis Armstrong impression. Yes.
There is a routine that he did, and I saw it on YouTube. I was looking at some of the things that he did that are on YouTube, which are reproductions, I guess you'd call them, recordings of stuff that happened, you know, many decades ago. And one of them was he went on Groucho Marx's game show, You Bet Your Life, And he pretty much upstaged Groucho himself, which is unheard of.
Yeah, he sort of barrels through. And it's a great clip to watch because you can see the enjoyment that both of them are having. They're riffing together and they're having a great time. And yeah, it's so rare to see anyone holding their own with Groucho. You know?
And it was great to see that Groucho didn't mind.
No, not at all.
So tell us about, there's this, you can do it, I'm not going to even try, but Hipsters, Flipsters.
Yes. Well, his first record was entitled Hipsters, Flipsters, and Finger Poppin' Daddy's Knock Me Your Lobes. And that was, he called it Hip Semantics. It was a hip retelling of Mark Anthony's funeral oration from Shakespeare. So Mark Anthony's, of course, is Friends, Romans, Countrymen, Lend Me Your Ears. Lord Buckley's version was Hipsters, Flipsters, and Finger Poppin' Daddy's Knock Me Your Lobes.
So he's basically doing Shakespeare updated into 50s hipster.
Yes. He did the famous to be or not to be was to swing or not to swing. That is the kicker. He also did a version of from Macbeth. You know, is this a dagger I see before me? And it was, is this the sticker? And so he was telling these stories and he was, you know, in a sort of rich storytelling tradition. He was taking well-known stories from the Bible, Shakespeare, that people know, and he was translating them into the hip language of that time, which is really a very old form of minstrelsy, of you know, telling stories and bringing information to the people. There's a rich history towards what he was doing.
It seems kind of hubristic if you're a purist about Shakespeare or anything else.
Definitely. I mean, it took great nerve to retell these stories. And, you know, if particularly the Shakespeare pieces that he did, he called Willie the Shake. Called him Willie the Shake because he shook people with what he wrote. And particularly with the Shakespeare things, it's almost line for line. Like, you almost need to have his text on one side of the page and Shakespeare's on the other to follow it, because his hip semantics are just as dense and poetic and full of language as Shakespeare's ones.
We're talking to Rod Harrison about Lord Buckley. The performance is coming up called Dig. Dig being, of course, does anybody say dig anymore?
I can dig it. I hear it.
Like so?
Yeah.
So, Clark, what is your role as producer? Are you also a longtime fan of Lord Buckley?
Well, not really. Rod and I have worked together at a couple of odd jobs, from Whole Foods to I was producing an event this summer, a nightclub, and Rod was working for me. He came to me one day and said, I want you to look at this YouTube link. And that YouTube link is over on the website, diglordbuckley.com. And so I checked it out, and it was an amazing performance that he had done. I guess over the summer at an intermission of the Gluey Brothers band. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I saw it, I just realized that this information and this guy, this Lord Buckley, needs to get out into, you know, into Santa Fe and into the world, and we need to, like, revamp this idea. I believe, and having researched him now, you see that most of what he's talking about is still completely current, and it's amazing work that I didn't know anything about, and now that I know so much about him, I feel ashamed for having not known about him previously. And so I sort of latched on and said, let's you know, produce this, let's go ahead and you know, get a space and get a venue and do some publicity on it. And it's been one of the easiest things to produce. People have just absolutely loved it. I was really nervous about putting it out there because it's so hard to explain to people. It's, you know, people don't know Lord Buckley. They're not familiar with this language and all in it. But as soon as people hear it, they absolutely adore this language. And then the people who know about Lord Buckley are just so excited to have, you know, somebody doing it. And really, there hasn't been anyone quite like Rod to do it. When we see it during and on different internet programs and all, there are people who are like poets or something like that who don't look the part, and they're not able to perform it in the way that Rod can. And so it's an amazing thing to produce, and I'm really excited to be a part of it.
You look the part to the point where it's uncanny. I mean, you don't have the height. He was a very tall man.
Yes,
but
yes.
Other than that, you walked into the cafe, and I thought, oh, my goodness, there he is, Lord Buckley himself.
Oh, well, great. I mean, that's the idea. You know, for this show, you don't see it a lot in theater, but you certainly see it a lot in music, that an artist will cover another artist's material. And, you know, there's a great jazz tradition of that as well. Yeah, just being such a huge fan of him, I wanted to cover Lord Buckley.
So have you been looking at his material? Have you been familiar with him for a long time?
Yeah.
He's an influence?
Yeah, he's certainly an influence on me. I couldn't tell you exactly when I found Lord Buckley, but, you know, hip people find hip things. You know, cool people know cool stuff.
It's true. It takes one to know one.
Exactly.
Which is why I don't know Lord Buckley.
But yeah, I've been a great fan of him for years. Actually, I ran into a friend of mine at the supermarket the other day, who we used to work together at Rare Bear, the belated old sad Rare Bear, the used
the
record store.
The wonderful record store. Well, used and new. It was a great place.
Yeah, Rare Bear was one of the coolest scenes in town. And my friend Nathan and I had worked there. And I was talking to him about the Lord Buckley show. And he said, man, I remember you were trying to learn those materials back then. You know, so it's been years that I've been, you know, interested in Buckley and wanting to do his material. And like Clark was saying, his material is so timeless. If you look at a lot of the comedians that came out that were contemporaries of Lord Buckley, even though he was older than they were, comedians like Lenny Bruce, Mort Saul, Shelley Berman, you know, the label then was sick humorists. They were sick comedians. And, you know, a lot of their stuff, if you listen to their records now, they don't really hold up very well. You know, the Shelley Berman stuff, the Mort Saul stuff, you know, even to a certain extent, the Lenny Bruce's materials.
It's dated.
It's very dated. Whereas as Buckley, even though he was using a language, a hip slang that is certainly of that time, the message is not dated at all.
What are some of the messages of Lord Buckley?
Well, he had a piece that I'll be doing an excerpt from called H-Bomb. And the premise of H-Bomb is an idea that Lord Buckley had to create a campaign against the bomb based on laughter. And so in this piece that he wrote, he talks about, you know, he wants to go to the bank, take out a bunch of money, and start a campaign on the radio, the television, newspapers, to get people to laugh at the bomb. So eventually, when anyone mentions H-bomb, you just think of a joke. And, you know, so a way of diffusing the bomb through...
No pun intended.
...through humor. Yes, exactly. But he has a line in that piece where he says, "It is the duty of the humor of any given nation in times of high crisis to confront the catastrophe that faces it in such a manner as to cause the people to laugh at it in such a way that they do not die before they get killed."
Wow.
Which to me is just beautiful.
Well, you think about Tina Fey doing Sarah Palin. Mm-hmm. Taking a potential disaster of the greatest proportions and making it just ridiculous through making people laugh. We're talking to Rod Harrison and Clark...
LeCompte.
Thank you. About Lord Buckley. The performance is called Dig. It's an evening with Lord Buckley, and it's December 12th and 13th. That's Friday and Saturday.
Also Sunday. We've added Sunday the 14th as well at 8 o'clock.
Tonight, tomorrow, and 8 o'clock. And it's at a space called A Squared, Art and Activism, which is on 2nd Street here in Santa Fe behind Back Road Pizza. Is this a new performance space?
This is an art and activism space, and they were really kind enough to donate their space to us. And so they're doing... art and pulp and political things, which is why they were excited about this event, because it merges the two of them. So,
would you like to, Rod, do a little routine or a little give us just a taste of what people are in for this weekend?
Sure. He has a piece called The Naz. The Naz is probably one of his most famous pieces. It's a retelling of the three miracles of Christ. The Naz, of course, being the Nazarene. I could do for you a small bit of the Naz healing the lame. I'm going to move this mic out a little bit. So the Naz and his buddies are goofing off down the boulevard one day, and they come across a little cat with a bent frame. And the Naz look at the little cat with a bent frame, and he say, "What's the matter with you, baby?" And the little cat with the bent frame say, "My frame is bent, Naz. Say, it's been bent from in front." So the Naz stepped back, and he put the glorious eyes of love on this here little kitty, and he looked straight down into the windows of the little cat's soul, and he say to the little cat, he say, "Straighten!" Up went that cat like an arrow. And everybody up jumping up and down saying, "Look what the Naz put on that boy. You dug him before, re-dig him." now.
Wow, Rod Harrison doing Lord Buckley. I mean, the amount of energy and the amount of full-onness that he had and that you have to have when doing a performance like this is pretty intense.
Yeah, he was very physical. He had an incredibly powerful voice. He could roar like a lion. He could whisper like syrup on pancakes. He had an amazing instrument and used it to the fullest extent that he could.
Now, he had, I guess, five wives. Is that correct, or six?
Well, he had... I believe he was very prolific. there was one woman who became his princess, and that was the Lady Elizabeth Buckley, and they held court for many years until his death. But before then, he was certainly a philanderer and a man in entertainment. You know, he has a beautiful line where he talks about, "It breaks his heart to see all these beautiful women in the hands of amateurs."
Oh, gentlemen, close your ears who are listening to this right now. So how did you choose the material that you're using? In other words, a lot of it is on recording, a lot of it is on film. There's so much of it. How did you go about making the selections?
Well, there's actually there's very little... you know, the Groucho Marx clip that you mentioned. Also, there's another piece that's on YouTube that's actually Lord Buckley performing, and he's performing in hip, and he's doing his you know, hip material. A lot of clubs, at the time that he was recording these records, they wouldn't take the risk to do this type of material. So the people that really heard the hip material were the people at coffee houses or at parties that he was at. He had much more straight material that he would do for these clubs, and so unfortunately there's very, very little video clips of him performing
film,
his hip stuff.
Right, but there's a lot on record.
Yes, he put out about six or seven records that are you know, re-releases and people snatching from different places. He had quite a bit of material. Myself, I wanted to find the pieces that one were the most sort of iconic Lord Buckley pieces, pieces like The Naz and another religious piece that he did, Jonah and the Whale, which is another piece I'll be doing. I also chose a piece that he wrote called The Bad Rapping of the Marquis de Sade, which is, you know, it's certainly not
Sounds
religious.
Sounds promising.
It's probably one of his darkest pieces, but at the same time, he's talking about humor. Even when he's talking about de Sade and de Sade's philosophies, he spins it in a way that it's a story about humor. And Buckley believed, and this is from the piece, that humor goes in a complete circle, like the world. That humor is the oil of the soul. And he talks about there are times when you hear something so wild and so crazy, something so insane, that you think to yourself, "Well, this is no longer funny." But if it is humor and you proceed further, instead of ending a negate under the license of humor, you'll find there's a whole nother strata.
Are you Lord Buckley or are you Rod Harrison right now?
that's Buckley. That's
okay.
Buckley. So I chose The Bad Rapping of the Marquis de Sade sort of to show the you know, the darkness and the humor that Buckley had. As an encore, well, not as an encore, as the final piece of the evening will be Lord Buckley's rendition of Scrooge from A Christmas Carol, just for the holiday feel. And then mixed in with that, I'm going to be doing some smaller pieces of his that, to me, sort of represent his philosophy and his take on life. Pieces like H-Bomb, another piece called The Horse's Mouth, and finally a piece called Religion. I was really reluctant to do an evening of Lord Buckley that contained a lot of biography material. A lot of times you see these shows and then, you know, in 1947 he moved the family to Chicago and he wrote this piece.
We don't care.
Right.
Right.
His work is so powerful that I felt that would stand on its own. So within that I tried to find bits that spoke about his philosophy.
Rod Harrison is Lord Buckley. Clark LeCompte is producer of the performance Dig, An Evening with Lord Buckley. It's tonight, tomorrow, and Sunday. It's at the A Squared Space, which is at 1807 2nd Street behind Backroad Pizza. And for more information, people can call the number 501-9944. Thank you both so much for being with us.
I would also like to add, just really quickly if I could, I will be accompanied by musician Lydia Clark.
Fabulous.
Who's an incredible musician, pianist, and singer. And she will be my jazz muse for the night.
Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR.
KSFR programming is underwritten in part by CASA. CASA is filled with delights and surprises to make the holidays special. Handcrafted folk art from around the world, books, world music CDs, jewelry, and toys for young and old. CASA is located at St. Francis Drive and Penn Road behind KFC and open Monday through Saturday from 10 to 5. More information is available at 982-2592.
I'd like now to welcome Jill Batson. She is the director of the Southwest Literary Center. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
So the Southwest Literary Center, what is it?
It's a space that's been around for about 24 years. It's on Monte Ray. It's a kind of space that is open for people to come and sit and read from our library and do some writing on their laptops and to hold workshops and book clubs and any literary pursuits. The Southwest Literary Center also holds the short story festival, and the writers' conference that will happen in September this year. But it's been, you know, pretty laid back for the last couple of years. Not much has been happening, and I've been hired to kind of rejuvenate the space. And so we've spent the last month or so repainting, refurnishing, refurbishing everything, and now we're ready to open the space on Monday the 15th.
It sounds like kind of a hidden treasure, is that there's this place where people can go. I mean, if you want to just go and sit there and read or write, you can do it.
Absolutely. And we have this great library that was, a lot of the books were donated, but we have a lot of new journals, new literary journals, new magazines, that kind of stuff. And yeah, it's really comfortable. There's Wi-Fi connection. There's a little kitchen where you can make coffee and tea. And so if you don't have a writing space at home, this is a great place to come. And you can just hang out on the couch with your laptop. And
do people use it to socialize at all, to meet other writers?
Yeah, well, we do have some writing groups that meet in the space, so poetry workshops, the book association meets there, so we have little, but it hasn't happened so far, but you know, the doors are open 10 till 3 o'clock, you know, or if you want to get a key, you can come later and socialize there. Yeah, sure.
So the library is, it sounds like a sort of perhaps eclectic and funky little collection of things that people have donated with no particular focus.
Yeah, it is actually focused now because we have a couple of interns that have actually, some St. John's grads that went through the books and turfed out all the things that they thought weren't desirable, and everything's alphabetized and all that kind of stuff. So yeah.
So you have some events coming up, and mm-hmm. one of them is a reading of a Child's Christmas in Wales. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that piece, first of all.
Yeah, it's a long prose poem by Dylan Thomas. We're going to be performing the piece on the 15th. It's an old Christmas standby. If you're not reading Dr. Seuss for Christmas, you know, you're reading A Child's Christmas in Wales. I'm going to be reading, Henry Shookman will read, and we have a special guest who's going to read the other part. So we're going to make it a three-voice reading.
And that is on December 15th at 6 in the evening. Mm-hmm. What day of the week is that?
That's a Monday.
That's Monday. All right, this is coming Monday. So are there, is the idea to have readings there on a more regular basis?
Oh, yes. In fact, as you may know, I used to do Vox Performer over at CCA.
Right.
So Vox Performer is coming with me. And we're going to start doing readings in February. We'll have bi-monthly readings. And a mix of local New Mexican people and poets from all over America.
Now, Tell us more about Vox Performa. I mean, you have brought in some really incredible people whom we featured here on the Radio Cafe.
Yeah. Vox Performa is basically a poetry series. Because I'm a poet, I have a lot of connections across, you know, North America, including Canada, which is where I'm from. And so every month we bring in...
You're not from Canada.
Well, okay, I'm from England via Canada, you know. So we bring in these kind of internationally renowned poets, Anne Waldman, Wanda Coleman, you know, these are people I know. And so they come, they do a reading, they do a discussion, they usually do a workshop as well. So the space at the Literary Center is going to be performing that function as well, is we'll be able to have the workshops there. They're very affordably priced. Everything is geared towards, you know, giving the Santa Fe community a look into that kind of poetry.
So in the Southwest Literary Center, when people show up there with their laptops, is there a designated quiet area where people have to work? Or what if everybody starts talking and somebody else is trying to work?
We're not that sophisticated. It's just one big open room with little kind of pods of couches around. So I think that, you know, when people are there to write, they're pretty much there to write. If they want to talk, they can come down and talk to us in the office downstairs, you know.
Now, there's another thing going on, which is called Vault. It's Works from the Marchand Loft.
Yeah. In our renovation of the space, we got rid of a whole bunch of potted plants and junk and cleared off a whole bunch of wall space. And so I really wanted to have a little gallery space there. And so now I have Lynn Marchand, who people might know is a very big collector, along with her husband, George Goldstein, is a very big collector of contemporary art, especially local New Mexican artists. And so I've asked her to become our curator for the space. And what better way to kick off the actual gallery series, I guess, is to show work from her own private collection. Many of these pieces haven't been seen. Probably a lot of people don't realize that she has, you know, such a big collection. But there's going to, you know, we have works on the walls at the moment by, you know, Jerry Schneider, Tom Miller, Catherine Lee, Joseph Boys, Victoria Carlson, Clayton Porter. You know, a whole bunch of renowned contemporary artist, and she's very excited about the space, as we all are, and it's what it is. It's a fantastic little show.
So all of that is happening at the Southwest Literary Center. The reading is Child's Christmas in Wales at 6 o'clock in the evening on December 15th, which is this coming Monday night, and they can be found on the web at literary center. Well, no. How can they be found on the web? I guess at recursos.org.
Recursos.org, yeah.
And the number is 577-1125. Anything else you want to let us know?
No, I think that it's an excellent opportunity for people to come and see what the space is all about and meet some artists and meet some writers. I mean, there's going to be a great meld of contemporary artists and writers there, so I think it's going to be a kind of cool little reception.
Well, we're delighted that you are doing this now. Jill Batson is the director of the Southwest Literary Center. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Jazz a la Carta. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you Monday. Have a wonderful weekend. Ciao.